This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. For 15 years, author Ridley Pearson has been going behind the scenes at Disney World, doing research for a series of adventure novels for young readers called The Kingdom Keepers. I talked to Pearson about how writing for kids has sharpened his skills in other genres. He's also part of a rock supergroup of sorts, with writers like Stephen King, Amy Tan and Dave Barry, who jam out to classic rock. Pearson began the conversation by talking about his novels for young readers.
For your listeners who don't know, Kingdom Keepers is a series of books about five kids who get inside the Disney parks in the Magic Kingdom, in Disney World. And they face all sorts of weird adventures because they're in there at night after dark when the parks are closed. And what usually interests interviewers and was no different in the PBS Kids Stew piece was she was interested in the backstage access that I'm given by the company. And I've had the most amazing time since I started writing this series nearly 15 years ago. Disney agreed to allow me backstage after closing hours. So I go into the parks with a Disney Imagineer, who is someone who is part of the design and the building of all the attractions. And we tour the attractions.
So one of the things I've heard about Disney, and I gather this is kind of part of the park design, is they have this kind of network of access tunnels, right? So characters can get from one place to the other and they can sort of move things around and not burst that bubble of the magic experience that guests are having. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, what did you discover about Disney that you didn't know before when you embarked on this project?
Yes, just so much. When you go in after hours and have full access, as they granted me, what you're talking about is the utilidors in the Magic Kingdom. The Magic Kingdom was built on swamp, and they knew they had to raise it 20 or 30 feet, so they did this huge earth-moving project to build it higher. And when they did that, they realized, hey, if we're doing this, we can build tunnels under the entire park, and they're wide. They're big enough for two lanes of golf carts to move back and forth. And I kept noticing this giant, to me, giant pipe mounted in the upper reaches of each of these tunnels, many of the tunnels. And my curiosity, which is what drives most of my fiction writing, got the better of me. And I approached the expert who was touring me, and I said, what's with this big pipe? What do you need such a big pipe for? Because it must have been 4 feet across. And he said, have you ever seen us unloading trash in the park, you know, walking around with crates or carts of trash bags? And I said, no. And he said, well, you know, you can imagine that 80,000 people a day create a little bit of trash. And I said, you know, I've never even thought about it. And he said, we'll go back up and I'll show you. But once you get out of the park, we have this system built. And the system is they suck the trash out of the Magic Kingdom. And when you get backstage in various locations, there are these things that look like submarine hatch. And when you lift it up, it's very heavy so that no kid would ever play with it. And when you lift it up, you hear this giant sucking sound and you drop a bag in there and it gets moved through 3/4 of a mile of tunnel and spit out into the world's biggest trash compactor, the size of an 18-wheeler trailer. And I saw that, and I said, well, I know where the kids are going to be at the end of my book. And that became a big part of the first Kingdom Keepers novel.
Was there any stuff that you saw, you know, in your travels with the Imagineers, and they're like, okay, you can't talk about this, this stuff that, you know, you're going to see along the way here that we would prefer to keep under wraps?
Probably 80% of it, yeah. I would say that on any given tour, I've now done 31 of these tours, and I have a new series coming out in 2020, so I expect to be doing more. But you see so much, and I never want to hurt the experience of any of us going into the parks. And I have found that by seeing even some of what happens backstage, instead of hurting that experience, it for me, it has never gotten old because of seeing sort of the man behind the curtain, But yes, you've touched right on it. I mean, probably 70 to 80% of what I see never gets into the books. And I ask both my editor and the Imagineers to review the books before they're published for both our sakes, both so they wouldn't see something they don't want, but so that I wouldn't reveal something that might someday, you know, impede or limit somebody's appreciation of the parks.
So, Ridley Pearson, you've had an experience that I'm sure a lot of people who are really into Disney would probably, you know, give, you know, they would pay a lot of money to have the kind of access that you've had. Do you feel fortunate that your job as a writer has given you this kind of backstage access to this place that so many millions of people come to see in Central Florida every year?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I just can't tell you. Every time it's, you know, every moment that I'm in there is a pinch me moment. And when I first spoke to them about, they had asked me if I could write kind of a adventure thriller, but for younger readers. This is years ago. And I said, you know, I could, but the way I write is I observe and then I write and then I edit. So I would need this access to your parks. And they said, well, you know, we just don't give that to anyone. And I said, no, of course not. And then they called and offered it. And it's such rare air. You can't believe how many hundreds of times when I speak to adults or kids, somebody comes up afterwards and says, if you ever need a research assistant, I mean, everyone wants to do this, but they won't even let my own family do it with me. I mean, it's a very private, secure visit we do each time. And as I said, you know, that I will take furious notes and they'll say, that shouldn't go in there. That shouldn't go in there. That should, and I'll go, okay. And we really work in concert to make sure that I don't blow it and gaff something out.
When the book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory first came out, Roald Dahl's novel, there was so much kind of fantasy in that story, right? Like the sense of literally walking in the shoes of a kid in a candy store with all this technology. Do you sort of feel like that kid a little bit?
I am totally that kid. In fact, as I was mentioning, I take sort of scrupulous notes when I'm in the Haunted Mansion after hours or Small World after hours or Space Mountain, whatever the case may be. And those notes then, of course, lead to me writing chapters. And when I'm writing the chapters of these books, that aspect, the behind-the-scenes aspect, writes itself so easily because I feel about 12 years old when I'm with the Imagineer and I'm just seeing this all fresh and new because you see so much you've never seen before. I've been through the Haunted Mansion, I think, 3 or 4 times with all the lights on. And it's actually, you would think that would somehow, you know, depreciate the experience. But it excels it. It increases it. You see so much that you don't have time to catch when you're on the doom buggies that now you get to stop and look behind where you would have been. And they take such care. I mean, you know, they've planned in case somebody should see this accidentally at some point. There's this little gag over in the corner that most of the time you would never see. But if you look right for it, maybe you'd catch a 30-second glimpse of it or a 3-second glimpse of it. And those experiences are just so rich to the writing experience.
Do you think, Ridley Pearson, that working in children's fiction has made you a stronger writer in other genres that you work in as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think that really I consider myself a storyteller. And so I approach my adult fiction much the same as I approach my younger fiction. I think my adult fiction is a little more R-rated, and certainly all of my middle grade fiction is G or PG rated at the most. But the basic storytelling, those essential pieces of storytelling remain the same. And as I got into the world of writing for middle grade and experienced these, you know, these just devoted readers who really know my work and my characters better than I, and they will ask me, you know, what's Finn doing today? And, you know, to them, Finn is this living, breathing boy. And writing for that audience means you have to be really on your game because they're going to catch problems. They're going to catch mistakes. And the great thing about young readers is they have no filters. They're perfectly willing to tell you where you blew it totally in your book and how they wish this was different. Adults are so much more gentle with you than younger readers. So over these 15 years of writing for both age groups, certainly the writing for the younger audience has, I think, improved my work in my adult world.
It sounds to me like when you're writing these books, whether it's the Kingdom Keepers or some of your other children's fiction, you're really thinking a lot more about what the reader is going to be experiencing as they're reading it, maybe more so than you would while you're working on some of your other genres.
Yes, certainly in the edit phase. And, you know, when I write, I think it's very important for young writers and all writers to never consider your audience. You just want to tell the best story. Publishers and editors can figure out how your audience is going to respond. So I think that the joy of writing these middle grade books is that I really am sort of a 12-year-old at heart. And when I start one of these books, I just am those characters. And I'm so excited every morning to get up and see what's going to happen next. And I'm so surprised when certain things happen. And then, as you say, when you get into the edit phase, I do, especially with the younger books, I greatly take into consideration that this is not just going to be read, it's going to be reread and reread and reread, and that makes the language important, it makes creating a succinct and tight story important, and most of all, creating as deep a character set as you can. So these characters live and breathe and become a really compelling force in what is now a 10-book set for the Kingdom Keepers, for instance. And when Dave Barry and I were working on Peter and the Starcatchers, it was much the same. I mean, we laid out the plot in a matter of about a week. We knew we were going to have right around 80 chapters and what was going to happen. But it took a year and a half, 2 years for us to write it and be in the shoes of those characters and try to, you know, bring more than just an action figure to a young character.
Dave Barry strikes me as somebody who would really be able to kind of preserve that sense of maybe like youthful joy in writing and creation, right? I mean, that comes across in his comedy. What was it like working with him?
For one thing, he's brilliant. You know, what I've learned over the years, now that he's introduced me to other humorists, is anybody in this world of comedy, I met Robin Williams once, I mean, they're just so smart. Stephen King, who is in a rock band with Dave and I, Stephen is unbelievably smart.
Wait a minute. You are in that rock band? Because I've heard about this thing.
Yes. I'm the bass player. I'm the original bass player. So it's Mitch Albom and Dave Barry, Amy Tan, Stephen King, Greg Isles, Scott Turow, Roy Blunt Jr., and me. In a crazy rock and roll band that plays 50s and 60s cover band. We're really awful, but we're awful for good causes. And over our 26-year history, we've raised about $3.5 million for nonprofits. And we've never gotten one bit better, but we've all made terrific friendships. And we really now play just to celebrate our friendship.
Do you have an album coming out anytime soon?
Well, did you hear the part where I said we're really bad? We've played for 26 years and we've never gotten one bit better.
People would still pay good money for that album, I think.
I don't know that they would. We sure have a lot of fun.
So what's next for you, Ridley Pearson? It sounds like you've got a lot of projects on the go, whether it's in young adult fiction or even some of your fiction geared towards older readers. What's next for you?
Yes, right now I have a trilogy of books coming out. The first has come out. Based in the DC universe, and I've written my first graphic novel, and it's about the son of Batman and the son of Superman. It's called Super Sons, the Polar Shield Project, and I have followed that with a trilogy of graphic novels that I've just started called The Indestructibles. There are two Kingdom Keepers series, one The Kingdom Keepers, and then the series The Return. And in the fall of 2020, the first book of a trilogy will be published called The Kingdom Kids, which is about the sons and daughters of the Kingdom Keepers. I'm also writing an adult thriller at the moment. So, yeah, I'm quite busy, but having a blast.
Serious question now. Who is your favorite Batman?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I love the Christopher Nolan trilogy. So I just adore that trilogy.
For the writing, the kind of direction more than anything?
Yeah, right, exactly. The dark direction of it, the Heath Ledger moment. But really, the storytelling is so well done in that. And clearly, they knew the whole trilogy before they started, and they connect all the dots so brilliantly. You know, writing series is really tricky. With the Kingdom Keepers, I wrote one book and thought that was probably it. And 2 years later, Disney came back and said, can you write more Kingdom Keepers novels? And then I had to think, well, could I? And if I did, how would that look? And so I ended up setting each book in a different Disney park, and then two of them on the Disney cruise ships. But I plotted that whole 7-book series prior, really, to getting into the third book. So I think Christopher Nolan with Batman did such an amazing job with the writers to just nail this thing as a trilogy.
I wonder, too, kind of thinking about your own series, does it occur to you that at some point another writer might pick it up? It might kind of become a franchise where you hand it on, similar to what the cast of superheroes have in these, you know, DC or Marvel movies?
I really haven't thought about that, but that's an interesting... I mean, I hope to live, but...
But I'm just kind of curious to know, because it sounds like, it's taken on a life of its own almost.
Yes, it has. I mean, the Kingdom Keepers sort of went from zero to hero, surprising us all, and that's why there's now a third series. There's talk about television. There's talk about all sorts of stuff, possibly even moments in the park where you would experience the Kingdom Keepers. So it's really exciting for me. And I hope to keep writing it, but I could see other people writing it, absolutely.
Well, Ridley Pearson is the author of The Kingdom Keepers and Peter and the Star Catchers, among others. Thank you so much for joining us, Ridley.
Thank you for having me on.
Still to come on Intersection, there's an abundance of lightning in Central Florida, which makes it the ideal location for physics professor Amitabh Nag. A conversation with Nag about what we do and don't know about lightning when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida is the lightning capital of the country, and that can be a problem for NASA and the commercial space industry working in rocket launches around the thunderstorms. But it's also a great place to study lightning, which is what Amitabh Nag is doing. He's Assistant Professor of Physics and Space Science at Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne. Nag's research could help the space industry, and it could also improve safety. So Amitabh Nag, this is, I guess, high season for what you do, because Florida is a pretty good place to be studying lightning, and in summertime you get the summer storms, the lightning rolls through. What kind of research is going on now, and what are some of the sort of latest things that you're looking into as far as lightning study goes?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Matthew. So you're right. I mean, lightning, the summer season is really busy here at Florida Tech. We are in the middle of a campaign where we are typically deploying equipment at various locations. We are busy analyzing data and looking at data as they come in through the door. So summer is indeed a busy season. Right now, our focus at Florida Tech is to examine some unique elements of lightning that have been discovered in the past couple of decades or so. And additionally, we are also looking at some of the sort of what are called the top 10 questions in lightning research. We are sort of trying to address some of those questions. For example, we are now looking into how lightning attaches to ground-based objects or to flat ground. So what I mean by that is when we look out into thunderclouds and we see a lightning flash come down to ground, it is a really fast process. It is over in a fraction of a second. And when we look into that, sort of what is going on during that 1 second, there are a variety of processes that tells us, that has clues about the physics of how the lightning channel is formed and how much current is associated with each lightning process. One of those physical elements, one of those physical processes that happen is attachment of lightning as this, hot plasma channel comes down to ground. And in response to this hot plasma channel coming down to ground, there are upward leaders, what we call upward leaders, which are essentially little electrical channels or sparks that are, you know, moving up from ground toward this downward moving leader. And a question that remains unanswered is, how does this upward leader connect to the downward leader? What does the signature of the process look like? How much current is associated with the upward leader? So we are looking into examining the characteristics of these upward leaders by putting current measurements on top of a nearly 100-meter tall tower at the Kennedy Space Center. So last summer, the end of last summer, we deployed these measurements on top of this tower, and we are now measuring currents associated with these upward leaders, which are initiated in response to a downward-moving lightning channel.
So what are some of the kind of practical implications of this? Are you looking into how to mitigate the effects of lightning strikes, or are there other things going on that, some of the research could lead to?
So, you know, apart from just understanding the physics of the discharge and understanding, you know, how this attachment happens, which by itself is, you know, very important for scientific advancement in this area, it is thought that it is, you know, generally we think that upward leaders from ground is a primary cause of lightning fatalities and injuries. So when we are standing anywhere on ground and there may be a thundercloud overhead and there may be some lightning in the area, first of all, we shouldn't be outside when there is lightning in the area.
Right, when thunder roars, go indoors. I think we've all been taught that in school, right?
Right, exactly. But if we happen to find ourselves in a situation like that, and if there is a lightning strike nearby, even if lightning may not strike us directly, there is a chance that there could be one of these upward leaders or currents that are moving up from ground through our body up toward the cloud. And the question is, how much current is associated with such upward leaders that may not directly attach to lightning, but may pack enough punch to actually cause severe burns or even deaths. So we are trying to, you know, the practical aspect of this is from grounded objects, what are the characteristics of these upward leaders that are initiated? As with any physical process, there's going to be a whole spectrum of these upward leaders that we are hoping to characterize and eventually also understand, not only their physical mechanism, but also the practical implications of these upward leaders in terms of lightning safety, as far as lightning safety is concerned.
Florida, it makes headlines as being the quote-unquote lightning capital of the United States. You know, it's a populous state. Maybe people aren't heeding the warnings to head inside if they hear thunder roaring and if there's a lightning storm. Or is there something else going on there? Are there other reasons why people are maybe particularly at risk for lightning fatalities in Florida?
When you look at, on average, lightning fatalities, this year there have been, as far as I know, there have been, you know, 5 fatalities this year. Over the last 10 years or so, the number of fatalities from lightning in the United States, I'm talking about, when I said 5, I meant in the United States. So nationally, the numbers range from anywhere between about 15 to 40, and it really depends upon what people are doing in a particular year and whether they're heeding the warnings or not. I mean, I've had people tell me that when they're mowing their lawn or trying to, you know, cut a branch off of a tree in their backyard and they see a thunderstorm, they sometimes will not heed the warning and try to finish what they're doing before they head indoors. And that definitely is a risky proposition. One thing that I often tell my students is, you know, when I'm heading back home from my office in the evenings, and it's a walk to the parking lot, and if there's a thundercloud overhead and I hear lightning, I'm really, really careful about stepping outside, knowing what I know and knowing what lightning can do. And the thing that goes through my mind is, I don't want the headlines to read "Lightning researcher killed by lightning" the next morning.
That would be ironic, I guess. So is that what keeps you up at night, sort of thinking about some of the hazards posed by the thing that you study?
Absolutely. I mean, that is one of the key elements. I mean, the hazards posed are not just directly to human life, even though that is a major factor. It's also to the infrastructure that we have on ground. One of the major reasons for scrubs of launches at the Kennedy Space Center, for example, is associated with weather and specifically with lightning. So, the more we understand the physics of different parts, different aspects of lightning, the better it is for engineering, the better it is for us making decisions. For example, when we are loading and unloading cargo at on a runway, when someone's doing that and the airlines or the airport has to make decisions about when to stop operations versus when to restart operations, given that there's a thunderstorm in the area, not only do they have to look into the safety of the crew and the people working outside, which is really very important, but they also have to try to be efficient because the length of the stoppage really does matter in terms of how much revenue they're losing. So not only do we have to be safe, but we also have to try to be more efficient. And the same thing applies for these space launches as well, where we want more launch windows to be available. And so we want to be making effective, efficient decisions so that safety is not sacrificed, but at the same time, we are not being overcautious and wasting time when it comes to launch windows. So there are all these practical aspects of lightning that are really intriguing, and it's one physical phenomena like many things that we other physical phenomena like hurricanes and floods and things like that are also sort of it directly impacts human life and it directly impacts infrastructure that we are building and does impact our day-to-day activities.
Is lightning only something to be kind of studied so you can work out how to get around it or how to mitigate the effects of it, or are there some beneficial aspects to lightning strikes?
Well, I mean, one of the things that that have been talked about in early lightning literature is the impact of lightning in initiating human life. I mean, lightning is associated with the production of oxides of nitrogen. We call them NOx. And so it played an important role, it is thought, in the early part of the sort of the Earth's cycle of going through, being an inhospitable planet to evolving to become something that can support life. It is thought that lightning played an important role in fixing nitrogen and bringing nitrogen from the atmosphere to ground, and that resulted in the evolution of organic life. So there are those aspects of lightning, and today, for example, lightning and its role in production of NOx and other greenhouse gases is something that is being examined as well. So lightning is something that is deeply woven into the fabric of the history of our planet and the evolution of life on our planet. The more we understand about it, the more we understand about what happens when, for example, our weather changes and our temperature changes on average over the years. What happens to lightning? I mean, is there more lightning? Is there less lightning? There are some studies that suggest that there will be increase in lightning, at least nationally in the United States, as there is an increase in temperature. So, there are these aspects of lightning that we try to understand. And all of this, of course, does have an impact in one form or the other on our lives, our daily lives on ground over here.
And you mentioned that the tower that you are studying, this particular, one of these unanswered questions about lightning, the research you're doing right now, that's over at the Kennedy Space Center. And you were talking about the kind of launch schedule. I imagine there's a little more of a commercial imperative to figure out, how to work around for lightning and how to make sure that lightning doesn't impede launches too much just because of the increase in commercial launches, right? We're in this new era of space exploration, which isn't purely driven by NASA right now. And so companies are trying to make money, figure out ways to do that. And lightning could be a pretty big barrier to that.
Exactly, yes. And that's why we have had some interest. One of the challenges that private industry has is that they have to be efficient. They're trying to mitigate as many losses as they can from various aspects of this launch operation, and scrubs happen to be one of them. So what they're interested in is trying to figure out how to make efficient decisions. And lightning is one of the major factors. Now, over the years, through scientific research, NASA and collaborators have figured out how to make these launches in a safe fashion. I mean, early on, there have been some challenges with lightning and some disasters associated with lightning. But later on, as the science evolved, as the understanding evolved, and as the government spent more money doing research in this area, they have figured out effective ways of keeping launches safe and the payload safe and so on. And But now, I guess, as you said, we enter into an era of commercial space activity. There is also the question of how to detect electrification early on in a cloud so that we can make effective decisions. But what I mean by that is, you know, there may be a rain shower happening in an area, and that cloud may not go on to be electrified and hence have the ability to produce lightning as a spacecraft passes through it. So, you know, in that situation, we necessarily do not have to scrub a launch. But we don't have all of the science at hand right now to be able to make those effective case-by-case decisions where we can say that, yep, this cloud is really not going to go on to produce any electrical activity. So even though there is cloud cover in the area, we may decide that, look, you know, I mean, this is just going to be a purely rain shower cloud and we can go ahead and, you know, safely launch versus us understanding that, yes, this in a cloud has the potential of producing electrical activity and additionally detecting that electrical activity or early signatures of that electrical activity within the thundercloud so that we do not go ahead with any launch activity or any ground-based activity associated with launches. So those are some key questions that that I think FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and others are interested in, as well as the commercial entities that are involved in these launch activities. So yeah, these are all relevant questions that need to be answered, and I think that there is some interest or increasing interest in this area to try to move the science forward so that we can move the technology forward with it.
Well, Amitabh Nag is an assistant professor of physics at Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure with you.
Still to come on Intersection, how a high school teacher turned Toadbuster. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. An invasive cane toad that first appeared in South Florida is hopping north. According to TV news reports back in April, a bufo toad secreting a substance that's toxic to dogs and cats killed a Tampa woman's dog. Janine Tilford is a high school science teacher who started Toadbusters after she realized there was nothing being done to curb the toxic toads. Tilford says her business is growing as the toad population booms. Well, Janine Tilford is with Toadbusters, the pest removal company. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm glad to speak with you.
These toads are kind of interesting critters, and I know there's a story to how you got started in this business because it is not your main line of work, right? You're a teacher, and then this is something that you started because you had a personal experience with the toads. I wonder if you just explain how that all got started.
Well, there's multiple reasons. Originally, I was a veterinary technician, and I used to handle the dogs that come in to the clinic that had been exposed to the toxin, and I realized there was nothing out there to help these people other than rescue the dogs. So kind of in the back of my mind, I was like, you know, this might be something to do in the future. And as I moved along in my career, I became a teacher and needed to bring in some extra income because teachers don't really make a lot of money. So this seemed to be a good idea to start because I'd be working in the evening. It wouldn't affect my day job. So I started it, and literally in like 2 months, we kind of exploded, and it's just been getting larger and larger every year.
So how long ago did you start Toadbusters?
It's going into its third year.
And have you had to expand your company, like hire some extra staff to deal with the demand?
Yes, we're about 8 technicians at this point.
So if somebody sees a toad in their neighborhood, they want to get rid of it, they give you a call. Are you kind of like Ghostbusters? You show up with the van and the suits and everything. How does that all work?
Actually, pretty much. They call us. We go out in the evening, usually as soon as it gets dark. We'll come out. We're wearing our uniforms. We have LED red vests that are safety vests, more for the safety of the technician. Because we're out at nighttime carrying bags, we've got a headlamp on our head. So, you know, it looks sketchy if we were in plain clothes because we're also carrying a bag. So it looks like somebody might be breaking into a house. So wearing the uniform, it keeps people realizing we are out there to be seen, not to be hiding. And we collect the toads by hand. We don't use toxins. We don't use any traps. you know, we feel that's the safest way for the pets and the people, and it's the most effective way to catch them that I feel. And also, it does not target any native species, which is one of the things that, you know, my company's focused on, is improving our native wildlife, not just the invasives.
What happens to the toads once you trap them?
Usually we have to humanely euthanize them. According to the University of Florida, we do a 20% benzocaine spray on them, which anesthetizes them, puts them to sleep. And then after they're asleep, they go in the freezer for 3 days, and then they can be disposed of.
So are people usually calling you because their dog or their pet has had an interaction with a toad and that hasn't gone so well for the pet?
Yes, a lot of calls on that the dogs have gotten into one. Some of them had died. Some of them haven't gotten into them, but they're afraid they will. Toads are also a nuisance in swimming pools and patios because they defecate on the concrete or in the pool, which is kind of unsanitary and very messy. So we do have some clients that don't have pets, but our primary customers have dogs or cats.
And has the science of helping pets out when they've come in contact with toads improved at all? Like, are there anti-venoms that vets can give a pet if it's, like, licked a toad or bitten a toad?
There's no anti-venom for them. Basically, what the technicians or the veterinarians do is kind of manage and stabilize the dog. You know, they'll give them fluids to help the toxin pass through better. We wash out the mouth again to make sure that there's no more residual left in the mouth. They're given other medications to control the symptoms, the seizures, the high temperature. And hopefully, you know, with all those interventions, we can get them through the toxin, and they usually, you know, recover within a few hours to, you know, a day or two, unless it's a really bad, and, you know, they get a lot of the toxin.
And you've seen what happens for yourself once a dog, you know, comes in contact with one of these poisonous toads, these venomous toads?
Yeah, actually, you know, I knew about them from forever, before I even had dogs. And I trained my Jack Russells not to go after them. But one day, one of the cane toads got into my patio, somehow either squeezed in through the doggy door or somebody left the door open. And my dogs went after it. And I turned around and came out of the kitchen, and my little Jack Russell's walking to me very, like, he's looking like he was drunk. I knew right away what he'd gotten into. His gums were red, his eyes were dilated, and I immediately wiped out his mouth, and we went off to the pet emergency clinic. He had gone into a full-blown seizure, almost died, but he survived it, and, you know, he was back home the next day. But it was a very traumatic, scary thing to watch. You know, I always tell people to be prepared for it, because it's time that matters, and if you are panicking, going through the phone book, trying to figure out who to call, you're wasting time. So one of the things that we do when we go out to the clients, we actually go through what to do if your dog were to get into it, so they're prepared and they have a plan. And that way you save time and, you know, have a better chance of saving your dog's life.
How does this toxin work? Why are these toads so dangerous?
Well, the toxin that they carry is extremely potent to animals. It's made in the parotid glands up behind the head, like behind each eye on the side. So you see these big, large glands on each side. So it's made there, but it actually travels through every pore of the toad. So it'll come out through the legs, through the mouth, through the body. So if a dog were to stumble upon it, whether they bit it or not, sometimes the toads can, you know, they kind of arch their back and it kind of trickles out the pores. It doesn't really squirt out. Everybody thinks they squirt it out at the pets. That's not the case. Usually what squirts out is urine. They get scared and they kind of pee. And that's the first thing that comes out. That's not any toxin. It's just urine, water mostly. But the white stuff that comes out, if the dog were to put his nose on the toad or step on it or bite it, that toxin immediately sticks to the inside of the mouth or the foot. And if the dog even later on were to lick his foot, maybe even an hour or so after he had, you know, stepped on it, they can get the toxin that way and it can show. So it's an immediate effect. The dog initially starts licking its lips, salivating, shaking its mouth. Gums get really red. The eyes go into full dilation. Dog starts to get hot and pant. And then as the toxin continues through, the dog starts to walk like he becomes drunk or, you know, confused. And then they go into a full-blown seizure. And if they're not treated at that point, eventually all their vital organs start to shut down and the heart shuts down. And it affects the heart after that and it kills them.
The story about these cane toads has been reported on in the Palm Beach Post, and then the story was picked up by The Atlantic. Is the problem worse now than when you started your business, Toad Busters?
It is. It got worse this year. And I think, you know, the problem is right now, and the reason why we're seeing a whole lot more this year is two things. I think, you know, these toads don't have predators, so they're reproducing at a phenomenal rate. I mean, the numbers are increasing greatly. And we didn't have a solid winter this year. We had a very mild winter, and the toads never shut down. Usually from the months of January, February to the beginning of March, we've had cold snaps that make the toads go dormant. The younger toads that were born in October, November, December, usually can't survive during the cold snap because they don't have enough weight and there's not enough insects to feed them. So they usually die off. But because that didn't happen this winter, the ground never got cold enough. They were able to stay warm. The insects were still around. And we didn't lose that group we normally lost. And on top of it, the toads started breeding at the end of January, which was a month earlier than they normally start.
Sounds like a perfect storm of conditions for these toads. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Janine Tilford. She's the owner of Toad Busters. We're talking about the explosion of these poisonous cane toads in South Florida. Janine, the toads have also been spotted as far north as Central Florida. Are you getting calls from places sort of further out than you can reach with your business?
Well, ultimately, we're planning on reaching everybody. We're focusing on right now South Florida and the East Coast, but I do have multiple calls on the West Coast, and we are heading further up north. So as we can, we're expanding to try to cover and help everybody. But, you know, it's hard to do, you know, as a small company. We're growing extremely fast. I mean, the numbers are amazing and it's great, but also, you know, service is important to me, and providing a company that is, you know, that does what we say we can do, you know, I want to make sure that we're sticking to that. So as much as I would love to expand everywhere, I want to, you know, focus on the areas we're in. And as we get a handle on it, we're, you know, probably every couple months we're increasing or expanding our area, and, you know, more and more techs are starting. And so ultimately, I hope Toad Busters will be able to cover all of South Florida, the West Coast, the East Coast, and Central Florida.
Have you thought about the possibility that this could be your full-time gig down the track some ways, or are you always going to be a teacher, do you think?
No, absolutely. It started off part-time, but literally showed me it was going to be a full-time job after the first year. I'm looking to probably eventually stop teaching. I'm going to try to hang in there for another year and just have the company pretty solid. But if things keep growing like they are at the moment, I may have to take a leave of absence next year, depending on whether or not I can, you know, handle all of the calls. It's still at nighttime, so it's still kind of away from my day job, but it is getting to be a lot of work between working, teaching high school, and then doing this. And then I even have a band on the side, and that plays 80 gigs a year. So it's starting to be a lot of work for me.
Sounds like you don't have much time for anything else. Janine Tilford, is there any kind of crossover between teaching and the work you do in toad removal? Like, do you talk to your kids, your students, about how invasive species spread and the biology of these toads as well?
Absolutely. I teach environmental science and biology and marine science, and we talk about, I share with them, you know, the excitement of what's going on in my business, not only on the environmental sense, you know, but how I started it and, you know, what drove me to find this business. And we talk about where the growth's going, and show them that, you know, you can actually do things that you love, and you can, if you, you know, put enough time and effort into something and believe in something, you know, don't be afraid to try it, because, you know, this is kind of something I've had in the back of my mind for years and go, you know, I don't think anybody would ever do this. But when I got into it, it was immediate, like an immediate startup. It started so quickly and people were so happy that there was somebody there because nobody wants to deal with them. People don't want to catch them. They're afraid of them. And like I said, it's growing as we continue to build out west, put in all these great lakes that we like to live on and look pretty. We continually make new habitats for these guys to thrive.
What about swimming pools too?
They do go into swimming pools. My biggest concern with them, the little guys drown usually. They can't get out. And they go into the filter. That's not my concern. My concern is more of when you get the adults in there and they defecate in the pool and then the bacteria that can build up and things like that is just kind of disgusting. Some of the pools I've been into, in the evening, the toads just go in there and it looks like they're having a party. They're under the waterfalls and hanging out at the steps and literally there's black spots of poop all over the bottom of the pool and the edges. And, you know, I know the pool guys complain about that because it really messes the pool up.
Doesn't sound too pleasant. Do you know how the toads got their foothold in Florida in the first place? Were they introduced as a pet or was there some kind of agricultural reason? I know that in Australia, cane toads were brought in for some version of pest control back in the day and that didn't go so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had two stories about it. Originally, they were brought in, like you said, in Australia, but they were brought in here for the cane grub as well, as a biological pest control. And I guess nobody really looked at the repercussions of these guys being toxic and the fact that the cane beetle flies and the toads can't catch it at that point. So they ended up taking over that way and they reproduced so fast that, you know, they got out of control fast. So that's one story. The other story was that they were brought in to the pet trade and a container of them or crate had gotten broken open on the tarmac at the Miami International Airport and they escaped from there.
I kind of wonder why anyone would want these as a pet. They don't sound too pleasant.
Well, if you're into reptiles and toads and frogs, they're actually pretty comical to watch. They get very large. They generally don't put the toxin out when they're not stressed. So, you know, you can handle them and play with them as pets and really not have any issue with them because the toxin doesn't, you know, come out unless they're really stressed out or if it's so full that you squeeze around the gland and in that case it might come out. But, you know, I've worked with them for years and played with them as a kid, and I never had any issues with it.
And I'm wondering, too, Janine, are there some toads that you have to look out for, the good guy toads, so to speak, ones that you don't want to catch by mistake?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a thing that, you know, I focused with on this business is I love Florida, and we have so many awesome species here. But the toads, the cane toads, have, like, pushed out our native species, the spadefoot and the southern. And I wanted to see if we remove the bufo toads from the area, are these guys coming back? And it's happening. I'm starting to see a huge swing of our native stuff coming back when you take these bufo toads out. And, you know, my fear with some of these other companies or people that collect and just kill the toads or they put out glue traps that catch, you know, all kinds of species, you're not targeting the one species. You know, you're affecting the native species, which we want to come back because we need them. We need them here, especially if we're taking the other guys out. So, yeah, we definitely want to see our native stuff come back. And as we take the cane toads out, these guys do return back to the area.
Well, Janine Tilford is the owner of Toad Busters. We've been talking about the invasive bufo cane toads. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And that interview first aired in April. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.